Certainly hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving with family and friends. We turn our eyes now toward preparing for Christmas, preparation. And as we were praying before the start of the service, not just praying and preparing for the 25th of this year, but that we might step into living every day of our lives in preparation for that day when He comes again and we see Him face to face. So I'd like to take us to Luke chapter 1 this morning. We're going to look at the record in God's Word of the story that we just saw acted out for us. And as we do Advent this year, we're calling it the cast of Christmas. A host of characters in surrounding the story, the events of that first Christmas. And we want to take a look at each of them, not just so we have better intellectual understanding of what took place all those many years ago, but so that understanding them and seeing the role that they each played in the story, we might better understand the role we play in the story as well, that we might be brought into the cast of Christmas as well, because of course we are meant to live out this story year after year in our own lives, aren't we? And so there's a variety of characters. You think of Mary and Joseph and the shepherds, not the wise men. They're not for a year or two later, best as we can tell. But Mary, Joseph, and the shepherds. And the one we're going to start with today, Zechariah and Elizabeth, you might not think of them right off the bat. Elizabeth is a relative of Mary's. We're not exactly sure quite how close they were, but she's a relative. And the events for that family with John the Baptist parallel, or maybe a better word is they're a forerunner to what's going to go on with Mary and Joseph and Jesus. And so we're going to start off looking at Zechariah, the priest, and using him really representatively for his family as a whole. And as I say, the hope in all of this is for each of us to be caught up in the story as well, to be drawn into it and to become characters in it ourselves. You might think of Cradle of the Cross this coming weekend. Think about what's going to go on with that. You're going to dress the part. You're going to move the part. You're going to mouth the part. You don't have to speak. Don't worry. you're going to mouth. There's going to be words. You're going to speak it out in a sense. And that's what we want to do in our lives. Not hypocritically as actors, but stepping into the role that has been laid out in advance for us. So I'd like to talk with us about hope this morning. Hope in the silence. And you see the outline there in the bulletin, the times when it appears like maybe there's nothing going on, maybe it feels like the absence of hope, but in reality, it's the times whenever hope is, in fact, building, and there's an anticipation of what is yet to come until finally that day when that which has been spoken becomes sight and hope itself appears. So the cast of Christmas today, the priest, Zechariah, Luke chapter 1, 5 through 25, hope even in the silence. Would you follow along with me as I read? In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there's a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both advanced in years. Now while he was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense. And there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. And he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. And Zechariah said to the angel, "How shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years." And the angel answered him, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. And behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time." And the people were waiting for Zechariah, and they were wondering at his delay in the temple. And when he came out, and here he was supposed to deliver that Aaronic blessing from number 6, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. The Lord turn toward you and be gracious." He's supposed to pronounce that priestly blessing. But instead, when he came out, he was unable to speak to them. And they realized he had seen a vision in the temple. And he kept making signs to them and remained mute. And when his time of service was ended, he went to his home. After these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and for 5 months she stayed out of sight. She kept herself hidden, saying, "Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people." And this is the word of the Lord. So first, I want to start off by just having us ask, why do you think the sign was that Zechariah would not be able to talk? I mean, really, what was the point of that being the particular sign? And as I've thought about it this week, and it's kind of funny, you know, you come to these Christmas texts year after year, and you preach on any individual one of them every so years, and so you've wrestled with it before. But coming back to it again, it's just, why that particular sign? And the nearest that I can phrase it is that it's perhaps something along the lines of, there is something in the nature of unbelief that it severs unbelief, that unbelief severs communication from a father until the miraculous birth of his son. Because John's birth was miraculous, wasn't it? I mean, not as much as Jesus Christ, certainly less so than that, but miraculous nonetheless. And this is what unbelief does. It breaks the relationship of the one the priest was meant to represent to the people. And then derivatively, it breaks the relationships horizontally. Like that one's the vertical one, right? From us to the Father the priest represents. But then derivatively, horizontally, it breaks our relationships with one another. Zechariah is not able to talk to his fellow people. He's not able to talk with his wife in the way that he had. Why that particular sign? And to think about it, and the point is not to get caught up in conjecture, but just to try to drive home this thought process that I've been in coming into today. I mean, why wasn't it when God, through Gabriel, gives the announcement, "Your wife's going to have a son after these many, many years," and Zechariah doesn't believe right away? I mean, if the point of the sign was just punishment, like, should have believed, you didn't. So, result, if it was just about punishment, what would the angel have said? "No son after all. All right, we're not doing that. You didn't believe? Fine, I'll go on to somebody else." If it was just about punishment, that would have been the sign. And if it was, if it was just about getting him to believe, right? You have this problem of unbelief, I want to solve it, because I think that after Zechariah walked away from that whole scene, he knew it was going to happen, didn't he? He was convinced. But if the point was merely to get him to be convinced, Gabriel, I think, would have done something like, "Okay, you don't believe? I'm going to snap my fingers. And when I do, Moses and Aaron, your forebearer, are going to appear right over there to the left side of the altar. Moses and Aaron are going to appear. And when they do, they're going to say, 'Dude, come on,' and then disappear. And you're going to know. And you're going to walk out." And had they done that, I don't know. This is probably too far down the road of speculation. Zechariah would have walked out and he said, "You're never going to believe what just happened." And he would have told them and he would have said, I didn't believe it myself at first, but then he did this and now I believe and you should too. And they wouldn't have believed, right? If it was just about punishment, fine, no baby. If it was just about getting him to believe, you're going to get another sign right here. But it's not about either one of those two on their own. It's about what? Conveying there is something in the nature of unbelief that it cuts us off from the one the priest is meant to represent to the people until the miraculous birth of his son. Now, and so there's this recurring theme throughout the New Testament. It's in Psalm 95, and then like Hebrews 3 and 4 picks it up in major focus. There's this recurring theme. They were not able to enter because of their unbelief. And so the people don't get the promised land. I mean, they get it, and then they lose it to exile, and then they come back, but they don't get it in full. They don't have full relationship with the Father. Instead, after they come back from the exile, what do they get? 400 years of silence, as the skit brought out for us. Do you know that 3,800 times in the Old Testament, there is some phrase, some wording along the lines of, and the word of the Lord came to so-and-so. Or, then the Lord said through so-and-so. His prophet, Moses, whichever the individual was at that time. 3,800 times God spoke. Can you imagine that? I mean, the frequency with which they encountered that spread out over hundreds of years, at times punctuated, but spread out over. And then, after the exile, 400 years of nothing from God. They were not able to enter because of their unbelief. It severed the relationship. Big picture. And of course, those effects of unbelief, they never just stay big picture. They always move into the personal as well, don't they? And this gets right up close and personal for us. They always move, it never stays big picture abstract. It always comes down into the individual lives of ordinary people. Because here are Zechariah and Elizabeth, and we read they are childless. You think they ever prayed for a child? Do you think they ever asked, could we please? Begging, crying out, God, would you answer this prayer? And for decades, silence. They got nothing. And I'm not saying that it was their individual unbelief at that moment, because right, Luke is at pains to point out to us that they were righteous in every way. This was not their fault. This is the consequence of life in a broken world. There's unbelief in the human race in general, and so we are separated from things working out the way they should, and you experience various degrees of brokenness in any one particular life. And at times you get to where you cry out to God, and it sure feels like the answer he gives is nothing. And so in this whole section on unbelief, severing the relationship, I don't mean it as, you know, hearing God's communication is some kind of subjective speech, and if you can't hear it for a season, well, then you've done something wrong to deserve it. No, not at all. This is the brokenness and unbelief of sin in general, causing all kinds of pain in individual lives. Now, not having a child is hard enough in any culture. Somebody desperately wants kids and doesn't or can't have them, it's hard in any culture. But in that culture, you might say it was even worse. In that culture, having kids was everything. As I said before here, you have a farm. In that culture, you have a farm. Who works it? Your kids. They are your workforce. Your village gets attacked. Who protects you? Who defends you? Who goes out to war on your behalf? It's your sons, right? Individually and collectively. You get old. Who takes care of you? There's no Meadowhaven. All right? Or whichever one you want to pick, there's none of that. It's your kids. for better or worse. Having kids in that time and place, I mean, as much as we have like the emotional, relational attachment to them in our time and place, in their culture, having kids was your social stability, your economic stability, your political and military security. It was everything. And here's a couple who was childless. And how they would have cried out to God year after year. May come back to this if we have time. I don't believe that Zechariah, when Gabriel says the Lord has heard your prayer, when he's there as a priest in the altar, at the altar, I don't think he's praying for a son there, okay? This is a once-in-a-lifetime gig. He is praying for the atonement for the sins of his people at that moment. He's 60 years old, 70 years old, 50? However old he is, having a son is no longer actively on his mind. And that's not why he's there. He's praying for something else. And God surprises him and says, in answer to your prayers for the atonement of the sins of your people, I'm going to give you a son. But it's after years and years and years and decades of it feeling like God had not answered the prayer. The times when the silence feels like God is not doing anything. The silence of hope's absent. Now, after that picture of divine silence, now we have the stage set to enter into Zechariah's silence in Luke chapter 1. Because by the time you get to Zechariah not being able to talk, I don't think he is being gloomy for the next 9 months, right? I mean, picture what's going on for him internally, too. This time now with Zechariah, now it's the silence of hope's anticipation. He realizes something is coming. So just try to picture what his internal mindset would have been, what Elizabeth's internal mindset would have been. Not only does she not have to hear from him for 9 months, but like the excitement of what is coming. We have not had their experience exactly by any means. No stretch of the imagination. But I know something of the pain of waiting for a child, right? And I know that if in any of those seasons, if God would have said, I will answer your prayer, you're just not going to be able to talk for a couple of months, done, right? Fastest deal I would have ever made. I will take that trade. So here's Zechariah. They've been longing for this. They've not gotten it. Finally, they're going to get it. You just can't talk for a little while. He would have put up with that. As indicative of unbelief on his part as it was, he would have gladly put up. Think of his excitement. Think of the building, the sense of anticipation over the next 9 months. So too, once we see that, so too in the exact same way, look back at those 400 years of divine silence and you realize this isn't God doing nothing, is it? Hardly at all. During that period of centuries, in the very same way, just over a longer period of time, God was building his work, laying out his plan, getting everything in place, preparing until that moment, till the time was just right for the birth of his son. There's preparation. When you get to the point where it feels like God is not doing anything, have the faith, to have the realization, this is not a silence of absence, but actually of anticipation, building, and you wait for it. Now, here's just a sidebar, okay? The same way that maybe you are browsing on the internet, and you see something, you want to keep going in this article, but you want to see that too, so you click on, you open a new window, but you keep this one as you go back to it. That's what we're going to do here, right? So main message line here, but just come over here with me for a second. You know, you can have a conversation, and scholars, commentators have a conversation about, with Zechariah, when he finally gets this divine revelation from Gabriel, when the epiphany finally happens, on the one hand, he's just doing his ordinary duty. He's just going about his everyday work. It's a mundane. It's an interruption of the mundane when Gabriel appears to him. On the other hand, depending on how you want to present it, Zechariah is doing literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You read there that the 24,000 priests, thousands and thousands of priests, they have divisions. There would have been 100,000 sacrifices that would have taken place in a short period of time at the temple in this time and place. And so you have a very organized system for approaching that. And so you have various divisions. One division comes on duty, another division goes off, and out of the division that is on duty, they cast lots, and one priest selected goes in and does this job that Zechariah is doing, and appears before the temple, and it was such a significant thing, you only ever did it once in your lifetime. So not just do you have to be selected by lot when your division happens to be on duty, but once you are selected for that task, like your name goes off the register, you're never in the pool for lots again. It is literally a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and that's the moment whenever God sends Gabriel to give this word of answered prayer to him. And so you think about those in both of our lives, in our lives, both senses. There is a sense in which you want to experience the presence of God in the mundane, right? In the ordinary. Like, not I'm going to step aside and do something different, and when I do that, then I get to encounter the presence of God. But no, like, as I go about my daily life, that's when I experience his presence. And it happens a lot in the Bible that way. You think of Manoah, Samson's father, and Manoah's wife. When does the angel of the Lord appear to them? They're just out in the field doing their work. Greetings. And they come. And so for us to get to a place to be given the grace where as we go about just the activities of bustling, ordinary, everyday life, you have a sense encounter of the presence of God with you as you do it. It's amazing. So think about that this Christmas season. All of the different things you are about to do for the next 4 weeks. And you bake, and you decorate, and you shop, and you wrap, and you visit your side of the family, and you visit the other side of the family, and you have people over. And for us to live in such a way that it's not, well, I have to do all of those other things, and then when I can finally get away from all that, then I can enter the presence of God. But no, as I go about that, I have an active sense of the hope of anticipating what he is up to as I do all those other things, in his presence in the mundane. But on the other side of things, how do you get, because it's distracting, right? As you shop and as you do all the details and as you spend time with people, it can be distracting. So how do you get to the place where you have that kind of felt sense of the presence of God as you do those things? Well, it sure helps if you step away for a while and you set aside time. And as you take that time to be with the Lord and to do your priestly duty of knowing his word and studying it and praying through it, you commune with God there in those special moments. And the more you do that, the more it's an upward spiral. The more you step back into the ordinary mundane and you know God there. The anticipation to get to where, and it doesn't necessarily feel like you're actively hearing from God, to know that even there, he is cultivating his hope within me and building up to, based on the miraculous birth of the Son that's about to come. All right, so that's the second. Now, third, it's all building until this miraculous birth. In the first instance, who is that Son who's born? Three, who's in the first instance, who is it? Well, it's John the Baptist, right? Think of the joy that they would have had, that which they have hoped for, not just these 9 months, but decades prior, has finally appeared. But ultimately, beyond John the Baptist, so far beyond that John leaped for joy when he first met him in their respective mother's wombs, far beyond John the Baptist, there's another son from another father, a father ending his mediated silence with the birth of his son, and that son would be his word in the flesh, hope itself appearing. And no more words are necessary. No more words are adequate. Everything that has been predicted, everything that has been described, right here in the flesh, blood and body, physical form, for us to see hope appearing. It's what we remember in communion. And how does that hope move into your personal life really. It never, right? It never stays abstract. It never just stays big picture. It always invades the personal, the individual. How does it do that in your life? Well, there was a time where that son offered a sacrifice. And he went to the cross, though he had done no wrong to deserve it on his own. And on that cross, Jesus Christ cries out, and what's the answer he gets? Silence. Nothing. And in that silence is the appearing of your hope. Because he is taking your place and giving you his. And that's the good news. When Gabriel appears to Zechariah, where is the angel standing? He's standing at the right hand of the altar. The right hand beside the sacrifice. You know, the right hand is the position, the symbol, the place of power and authority and merit. And Gabriel doesn't go to Zechariah's right hand and say, "Oh, now, good priest, you have finally lived enough years the right way. You have finally, having been chosen by lot, stepped in and offered the one sacrifice we have been waiting for you to make. You've finally gotten it right. So based on what you have done, here, your prayers are going to be answered." No. Gabriel doesn't go to Zechariah's right hand. He goes to the right hand of another beside a sacrifice. And based on the sacrifice offered on his behalf, Zechariah's prayer is answered. He is given hope. And through the chain of events that sets off, the sins of his people are atoned for. And they are restored back into relationship with God the Father. The communication has been reopened. All of that, right? When Jesus dies on the cross, the curtain keeping people out from the temple is torn so we can go in. That which only Zechariah could go into one time, once in his life. No, it's torn up. So we all have access. We all can be restored. And so that's the offer that's available to you today. That's what we remember in communion. When we get to where we say, by his grace, it's not anything that I have done to deserve this, but solely based on what he did on my behalf. Am I confessing my need for him? And receiving his sacrifice in my place, I can be as well restored to right relationship with God the Father. In the same way that they had a promise that the Messiah was coming, and they were waiting for that day when they would see God in the flesh, we too have a promise. And we are waiting for a day when he comes, not for the first time, but for good. And divine speech becomes sight. And we see him face to face. Let's remember him and keep on believing until that day. In the busyness, in the stillness, in them both, may God give you grace to have hope, to believe, to know that he is doing his work, accomplishing his good purpose, preparing all for that moment when the time has fully come. I encourage you to pray for the Cradle to Cross outreach this weekend, that it would be effective, that it would display his glory, that God would be pleased to bring salvation through it. So pray for the volunteers, pray for each one who comes through that nativity, and for each one of us, let's go, let's step into the role that he has laid out for us this Christmas season. Amen.